Broadcasting presents Dean Spanley, voiced by Neville Watchhurst on behalf of MCS Agency. A detail showing the eye and the nose from a figure on an ancient pot forms the Icon Films logo. The logo of the New Zealand Film Commission unfurls. Silhouettes, as if cut from black paper, form the image of a dog sitting among trees baying at a huge moon. Leaves are blown upwards, accompanied by a flight of birds which soar up among silhouette clouds, in association with Screen East Content Investment Fund, Aramid Entertainment and Lip Sync Productions LLP. A silhouette of a church spire and frontage opens onto a perspective of columns and arches and swinging bells. A silhouette shows a small boat being rowed across stormy water by two young boys. Starring Jeremy Northam, Sam Neill, Brian Brown and Peter O'Toole. Music by Don McGlashan. A cartoon horseman stands on the crest of a range of glowing orange sand dunes formed from newspaper articles about the Boer War. A vintage car tootles across the ridges of newsprint. It causes a paragraph of words to unravel and spin downwards. They transform into lines of bright gold light which swirl into the shape of a wine glass. They fuse into a circle of gold light, which then resolves into the words Dean Spanley. Curling black silhouettes close over the title, and then open again to reveal a man of cultured appearance in a long coat and a slouch hat coming out through a stout wooden front door onto a street. He walks along the pavement, touching his hat to passers-by.
Morning.
It is a commonplace observation that remarkable events often have ordinary beginnings. Never was this more true than of my talks with Dean Spanley, which form the spine of our narrative. Properly speaking, they began on a Thursday, the day on which I visit my father, Mr. Horatio Fisk. This habit, one might even say ritual, commenced after the death of my younger brother Harrington in the Boer War, and the subsequent demise of my dear mama, occasioned by her grief at this unsupportable loss.
The man has arrived at the top of steps leading to the back door of a grand townhouse. After knocking, he turns his grave face to the milky sky across which tumble a flight of pigeons.
Morning, Mrs. Brimley. How are you today?
As you see me. Could complain, but what would be the use of that?
Yes, indeed.
He follows the slightly frazzled-looking housekeeper down a narrow staircase.
And himself?
Oh, he's working himself up into air to steam. You know how he gets. Sent back the paper he did, to have it properly ironed. I'm just finishing the obituaries, and you can take it into him.
I didn't read the obituaries.
No more he does. But he wants them ironed, just the same. Says he doesn't read them because he's afraid he'll come across his own name one day. I ask you.
The man leans over to look at the newspaper she is ironing. Among ads for remedies for horses and cattle, he spots an announcement for a lecture by Swami Nala Prash on the transmigrations of souls. He half smiles and looks thoughtful for a moment.
Do you believe in the transmigration of souls, Mrs. Brimley?
I don't believe in letting foreigners in, if that's what you mean.
No, reincarnation. Not immigration. The belief that the immortal soul has many earthly homes.
Well, I haven't given it much thought, I haven't. After Albert died, I went to one of them mediums, but she couldn't get hold of him. I wasn't surprised, mind you. He never said much when you were alive, Albert didn't. I couldn't imagine him piping up once you were dead. Mind you don't crease that now. You won't know what day it is, not having seen the paper.
The man emerges from the basement kitchen carrying the pressed newspaper and walks down a tiled hallway. Stopping at a door, he smiles across at a framed oil painting of a young woman. Then, his smile evaporating, he turns to knock on the door. He listens for a response, but does not seem surprised not to get one. He opens the door and walks discreetly into the tastefully furnished and pleasantly light parlour. In one of a pair of wing chairs before the fire sits a very elderly, almost cadaverous figure. The man looks down at him. The old man slowly turns his cold blue eyes upwards.
Oh, young Fisk, it must be Thursday.
It is indeed.
Very handy a Thursday. Keeps Wednesday and Friday from colliding. Go here, then.
Horatio Fisk takes the newspaper and ignores his son. The younger man turns slightly awkwardly away and gazes critically out of the window.
You really should have the garden seen to, Father.
That was your mother's job.
Nevertheless.
Nevertheless? What does that expression mean, I ask you? Nevertheless? Might as well be clearing your throat for all the sense it makes.
Well, it's a fine day, Father. Have you anything particular in mind?
I can see how fine the day is. As for particular in mind, everything is particular when you get down to it.
What I meant was, do you have any plans? Are there any concerts or exhibitions? Diversions you wish to attend?
There's nothing about the war.
We're not presently at war, as far as I know.
Diversions, you say? That's all that's left, you know, before stepping out of the anteroom of eternity. There is a display of aboriginal weapons from our wars of imperial conquest.
Such was the common procedure of my relationship with my father. I, carrying out my filial duty, would arrive with the best of intentions. He, indulging his practiced yet primitive paternal instincts, would play a strange game of control. As Thursday upon Thursday arrived, I'd become more and more determined to see this game dismantled.
Collection of Georgian shoe buckles, over 2,000 items. Now, that was an era when a gentleman could spend a fortune ornamenting his feet. Did we win the Boer War?
I believe we lost more slowly than the other side.
Garden never recovered from it.
Now, there is a lecture by one Swami Nala Prash on the transmigration of souls.
Poppycock. Think if we had souls, they wouldn't get in touch. Of course they would. Think your mother wouldn't be on to me about that garden? Of course she would.
Still, it seems the most likely of the lot, wouldn't you say?
It's being held at the home of the Nawab of Ranjiput. Isn't that the cricketing Indian chappy?
Yes, I believe so.
Oh, well, let's take a look. Heard tell he's turned the ballroom into a cricket pitch. Mad as badgers, these Nawabs. Oh, by the way, I've invested in a chair vehicle. Makes walking unnecessary. You'll enjoy it. Mrs. Brimley! My chair! Watch your step, young fish.
Thank you, Father.
How is it going?
Very smoothly so far.
So it should. Latest model, guaranteed to last longer than the user. Not that that means very much.
Nonsense, Father.
Fisk pushes his father towards a very grand house with a pillared portico. A very early model car hoots.
Be the debt of all of us, they will.
Progress, Father, occasions certain inconveniences.
How are you?
Ready, well.
The Indian doorman smiles at them.
Hey, ho, welcome, chair.
Give you a hand with the buggy? Bravo, it's kind of you.
Buggy, indeed.
My pleasure, sir. Clyde built by the feel of it.
A doorman admits the two Fisks into a gigantic ballroom with a cricket pitch inset into the sprung floor. Men in whites are at play while an Indian sitarist sits playing in a corner. Horatio Fisk looks on, eyes wide and nostrils flaring.
Thank you, thank
foolish game, cricket, if you ask me. Too many rules.
They now walk along the balustraded gallery above the pitch. Others are present, including a sombre-looking, bearded clergyman sitting in the back row.
Not exactly a full house, is it? Want to be where we can see the yellow of his eyes? I declare, that's Stanley, Dean of St. Justice. Not that I ever go there, so he may have been kicked out by now.
Father, please keep your voice down.
What?
The motorist who helped carry the bath chair approaches.
Dean Stanley, did you say?
Not me, chap with a dog collar.
It's a dean doing it, a sermon on reincarnation. That's what I'd like to know.
Exactly my thought.
I think it shows commendable open-mindedness.
Impending apostasy, more like, seeing the error of his Christian ways.
The name's Rather, with a W.
Fisk.
What brings you here, Mr. Fisk?
Ask young Fisk his idea.
The lesser of several evils.
A young man in cricket whites and a striped blazer appears, clutching a bat.
Well, there you are. I thought I got a thin edge onto my pad. But when the umpire raises his finger, you have to walk. That's life. And cricket. Well then, time to bring on Swami Prash. Of what he will tell you today, I have no particular opinion, but I've always held him in high regard as a cricketer. Bowled decent left-arm leg breaks before he went holy. I haven't seen him play since, but I've no doubt he's still the sportsman he was.
Horatio has been listening, impishly transfixed. Young Fisk watches seriously as the Swami appears in a dark suit.
I confess the appearance of Swami Prash came as something of a surprise, even a disappointment. For although I had no clear expectation of what a holy man would look like, I had imagined one with such a title and discussing such a subject to have been dressed more traditionally.
The Swami sits elegantly in a peacock tail cane chair and places his palms together. The small audience look on intently, including the dean, who watches from the back.
The question of the transmigration of the soul, perhaps more familiarly known to you as reincarnation, has been the structural underpinning of Indian philosophical and religious thought for millennia. Only recently...
What ensued proved to be as unilluminating a 50 minutes as I can remember spending outside the confines of parliamentary debate. Indeed, the most significant fact I gleaned from the experience was that with my eyes closed, the lecturer could have been a Welshman.
A little, if only a little, closer.
Fisk Sr. is asleep.
I should be pleased now to answer any questions you may have.
Well, am I?
Be quiet. You are, my dear sir, in the anteroom of eternity with the rest of us sojourning souls.
What?
Yes, madam.
We were wondering if...
He said the anteroom of eternity. What?
Animals. Shush. If they pets, really. The souls of pets.
That is a most interesting question. And I thank you for asking it. It is generally supposed that the animal soul must be of a different and by inference inferior nature to the human soul. The soul is that part of the Godhead, of all that is.
What you said before, sir, about the anteroom of eternity.
Would you be kind enough to allow the Swami to finish his thought, sir?
Well, well. Shh. What? Shush.
Fisk glares at his son. The Swami nods gratefully to the dean and continues.
However, although all animals have their specific awareness of the Godhead, the dog is by virtue of his singular relationship with all mankind, unique.
What about cats?
The dog amplifies. The cat diminishes man's estimation of himself.
Poppycock!
So I shall wish you gentlemen good day.
I can be found here most mornings and of the occasional evening.
What exactly is a conveyancer?
Well, nothing exactly. More a service of facilitation, assisting a thing to be moved between parties.
So you're a middleman?
Well, sometimes in the middle and sometimes at either end. Been a great pleasure, sir.
You're easily pleased, is all I can say.
Ratha gets back into his car and pootles away, now with a woman in the passenger seat. Fisk tucks a rug around his father and pushes him in the chair.
Only thing that makes sense in the whole damn farrago is what the chap said about dogs thinking you are better than you are.
Canine flattery is a survival mechanism, according to Darwin.
The chap never had a dog, is all I can say.
I thought he had a beagle.
I had a dog once. Wag. One of the seven great dogs. At any one time, you know, there are only seven. Did you know that?
Can't say I did.
Neither did Goswami. Made me think he didn't know much about dogs. Let's go to my club. Have a stiff one.
I thought you didn't go there anymore.
That was in the past. This is the present, young Fisk. There's no time like the present, as that Swami calls it. What was it? The eternal now?
No, sir. I wasn't listening.
The two Fisks climb a steep carpeted staircase, emerging onto the gracious landing of Horatio's club.
Ah, how are you, Marriott?
Yes, I'm well, sir. And yourself?
Oh, one step nearer the grave. How's that boy of yours? Tommy, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Tommy, sir. He's dead, sir. The war, sir. The Boer War.
And the Boers. Lost one myself in that nonsense.
Haven't seen you for a while, sir.
The two Fisks enter a grand library. A man sits reading a newspaper near the door.
Hasn't changed much.
Clubs aren't supposed to change, surely. Part of their charm. Mm-hmm.
Horatio peers into the next room.
There's that chap again. Is he following us?
Where are you going?
Fisk Sr. marches up to where Dean Spanley snoozes in a chair.
Fisk!
What?
Horatio Fisk. This is young Fisk. Surprised we were to see you at the Nawab's.
Oh, yes, yes.
So, what did you make of all that mumble-jumble?
The beliefs of others are always of interest.
Really? Then tell me this, then. Why don't they get in touch? Souls, I mean. Never a word from beyond the grave. You'd think one of them would have given a shout.
Well, I imagine if the Swami is correct, they're all too busy being whoever they've become.
What about him pinching my line?
What line was that?
The anteroom of eternity.
Well, I'd rather thought that common usage.
Not at all. Out of my own head that came. Rather like having your pocket picked. What's that you're drinking?
Oh, this is Tokai. Not an imperial, I'm afraid, but good enough for all that.
It's a bit syrupy for my taste. Well, we'll leave you to it.
You must excuse my father. He can be rather impulsive. Not at all. Pardon me, Dean, but am I to understand you give some credence to these beliefs?
Only the closed mind is certain, sir.
Oh, I agree. I agree. Good day, sir.
Good day to you, sir.
Young Fisk smiles delightedly and leaves Dean Spanley looking slightly bothered. Fisk joins his father in the adjoining room and unfolds a newspaper. Horatio continues glowering at Spanley, who casts a wary look through the doorway.
Rum chap, Spanley.
Do you know him well enough to form that opinion?
One can tell. Not quite sound. Dabbling in Eastern religion, drinking that Hungarian treacle.
Can I get you gentlemen a drink?
I like a brandy and soda, Marriott, with the emphasis on the brandy.
I'll have the Tokai.
Oh, I'm afraid that won't be possible, sir. The Tokai is private stock. The Dean keeps a bottle for his personal use. Very hard to come by, I believe.
Damned unsociable of him.
Told you the fellow wasn't sound.
In that case, I'll have a brandy and soda as well. In the inverse ratio.
Of course, sir. If I may say so, Mr. Fisk, I'm most sorry to hear of your loss.
What?
Your boy, sir, in the war.
Wasn't my loss. He's the one got killed.
So. That was even for you, Father, a singularly callous remark.
Nothing of the sort. Here we sit, about to be served brandy and sodas. What's our loss compared to your brother's?
Back in the street.
Women with a vote is like a cow with a gun, contrary to nature.
Walking home, listening to my father assert a variety of things in tones of unbrookable authority, Dean Spanley's words return to me with renewed force. Only the closed mind is certain.
Mrs. Brimley slops food onto Horatio's plate and bangs it down.
An excellent hot pot, Mrs. Brimley.
Well, it ought to be, seeing as I've made it to you about 500 times.
Thank you.
She serves Fisk Jr. rather more genteelly, in the parlour.
It may well be supposed that this turn of events came as a most disagreeable surprise to Mr. Chuttleworth, accustomed as he was to having his every whim catered for. I confess I had, until that moment, always supposed certainty to be rather a good thing. Like money in the bank. But something in the day's events had occasioned in me a certain disquiet. A sense that...
There may be more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Fisk puts aside the book from which he has been reading and gets up quietly, leaving his father sleeping in his wing chair. He crosses to the door. As he opens it, he casts a look behind him to where his father murmurs in his dreams. Fisk, outside in the hallway, closes the door carefully. He turns and gazes towards the door of another room. He opens the door into a spacious half-lit room in which stands a grand piano and a cluttered circular table bearing a globe. Fisk walks a couple of paces in and gazes around. He walks further into the room, looking around with an expression of muted sadness. He steps up to a large desk, which is covered with handwritten letters, items of laboratory equipment, glass-stoppered bottles and books, including a study of British moths. He picks up a framed sepia photo of two boys. He gazes at it and then looks into the distance. Across a wide expanse of rough grassland, a young man ambles along on horseback. He wears a bandolier across his chest and has a rifle slung at his side. He appears battle-weary. He looks to his right and up into the sky where hangs an enormous full moon. Fisk rubs his thumb fondly across the glass of the photo frame. He opens another door.
I'll be off, Mrs. Brimley. He's dozing in the study.
Oh, I'll have to wake him up. Otherwise he won't sleep tonight.
Fisk seems to be steeling himself. He closes the door behind him and approaches Mrs. Brimley.
Does he ever mention my brother?
Your father doesn't hold with grieving, Mr. Fisk, as you well know.
No, that's right. No, you're right. Thank you, Mrs. Brimley. And thank you for the hot pot.
Oh, don't you start, young man. Hot pot, that's all he let me cook for him. Creature of habit your father is. Knows what he wants without having to think.
Certainty of a closed mind.
Well, I don't know about that. But you do know where you are with him. Where you was before. Nowhere.
Bye-bye. I'll see you next Thursday.
Like as not. Creatures of habit. Oh.
Onto a stout wall of flint stones is cast Fisk Jr.'s tall, slim shadow as he walks.
I've heard it said that one encounter is a happenstance, two, a coincidence, and three, a significance. Be that as it may, that day I found myself, for the third time, in the presence of Dean Spanley, a man who, until that day, I did not know existed.
Spanley peers into the branches of a tree.
Is it stuck up there?
Rather pierce out. And everything of that when they go up, which I consider a serious reflection on their intelligence.
Probably chased by a dog. Dean? Dean Spanley? Hello. I met you earlier at your club. I was introduced by my father, Mr. Fisk.
Oh.
And you were at the Nawab's.
Oh, yes.
I am most eager to hear your further views on the subject of reincarnation.
I assure you, sir, I have no special knowledge on the matter.
Compared to my own, I'm sure yours are encyclopedic. I was wondering if I might invite you to dinner one evening.
I'm afraid that with my schedule, that would be rather difficult.
I would not presume upon so short an acquaintance were it not for the fact that I've recently come into possession of a bottle of Tokai, an Imperial Tokai.
An Imperial Tokai?
Yes.
One must be on one's guard against the common or garden variety. What year?
An 89, I believe.
An 89, you say?
Is that a good year?
Oh, yes. How do you come to be in possession of such a treasure? You must be very well connected, Mr.
Fisk. Henslow Fisk.
Well, perhaps I might manage Thursday, if that would be convenient.
Most convenient. Shall we say 7 o'clock?
Very well. Until then.
Good day, sir.
89? Goodness me.
I wouldn't call it a lie, Puss. More like a truth deferred. Nothing worse.
Henslow Fisk walks down an obscure cobbled street towards a wine merchant's.
It had not occurred to me when I made my overture to the Dean that procuring his favourite tipple would prove such a challenge.
He crosses another street towards the premises of Mortimer's wine and spirit merchants and opens the door.
Very hard to find an Imperial Tokai, sir. Of course, there are what you might call commercial counterfeits, but the real thing, it's another story altogether. It's made solely for the Habsburg monarchy, you see. Takes a royal decree to have one uncorked. You would need to know somebody with such connections.
I see. Tell me this, if King Edward himself were to come to you and say, find me one or two bottles of Tokai, what would you say to him?
Well, I would suggest, most respectfully, that he uses his family connections in order to effect the conveyancing. So I'd have a lot more chance of success than I would, sir.
The wine merchant regards Henslow sniffily. Fisk, meanwhile, seems to have been galvanised by the word conveyancing. He walks along a street and over the threshold of a substantial house outside which is parked Rada's motor car. Rada leans across a billiard table in a room stacked with curios, including a wall full of stuffed animals.
Point of the exercise. Drop every ball without a miss.
Care for a small wager?
No, thank you. You seem more than capable of performing such a feat.
So you'd like to acquire a bottle of an 89 Tokai, an Imperial. Is this an adventure of the romantic sort that you're embarking on?
Certainly not. It is said that the fair sex responds avidly to Tokai, loosens the morals, and with it, the courses.
How high are you willing to go?
Whatever it costs. Within reason?
Ah, yes, well, you see, there's the rub, within reason. 89 Tokai, not easy to come by.
So I understand.
So what's your line, then?
Oh, this and that. About publishing.
Any money in it?
a modest remuneration. But the real reward is in the art itself. Though, I must admit, there must be rather more to be made in conveyancing.
That's not all mine. I'm just a ground floor tenant.
Rather leads the way into an outhouse full of bizarre items.
How on earth did you come by all this stuff?
My Auntie Molly was a hoarder. Bought it from her, I shouldn't wonder.
What do you do with it?
Oh, you never know when someone wants something you just happen to have. Such as a bottle of Imperial Tokai.
Really?
Fisk hurries over to inspect the bottle.
Good grief.
It's not an 89, I'm afraid. Will a 91 do?
It'll have to. I suppose I could say I was promised an 89 and the man was mistaken. What do you think? How much is this?
5 guineas, dear.
5 guineas? That's a bit bloody steep.
These little things were sent to try us, as the man said of the pygmy judge.
Fisk examines the bottle ruefully.
Thursday? Are there not 6 other perfectly adequate days, each equipped with portions of time suitable for such activities?
Thursday is the only day the Dean is free.
Poppycock. Deans have dinner every evening.
Yes, prior engagements.
And is my Thursday not a prior engagement, young Fisk?
Henslowe fixes his father with a look of incredulous reproach.
What is going on? You're not getting married, I hope.
No.
Good. If I had to do it over again...
Am I to understand from that remark that you regret marrying Mother?
Fine woman, Alice. Very good in the garden. No. It's the children. Hostages to fortune is what they are. But there is no point to regretting things that have gone to the trouble of happening.
And that is your reason for refusing to mourn, Harrington?
I warned your brother that the war would be bad for his health, but no, he knew better, the young fool. Anyway, your mother mourned him enough for both of us.
Perhaps if you'd shared that burden with her, she might not have found her grief so insupportable.
Horatio stares back, wide-eyed and tremulous. Young Fisk seems to regret his remark.
I have nothing more to say on this subject. Please never mention it to me again. Close the door on your way out.
Henslowe turns away, crestfallen. Mrs. Brimley sits by the fire in her parlour. Henslowe opens the curtains roughly.
Do you miss your husband, Mrs. Brimley?
Miss him? Well, it weren't hard to miss were Albert. Kept himself to himself. Sat in that chair, night after night, never said a word. Just nodded, sociable-like. And spat in the fire every now and again. That were Albert's one bad habit. I talk to the chair sometimes, and it's just like old times, except the chair don't spit.
Fisk crosses and sits in the chair that was Mr. Brimley's. He turns away, his expression disconsolate.
Thinking about your brother and your mum, are you?
I just wish Father would...
Well, Mr. Fisk was never one for showing much. Why, I remember that night up at the lake when you and young Harry went out on that cockle shell of a boat.
Yes. On one of his finest moments. I'll let you get on, Mrs. Brimley.
Good night.
And don't you worry about Thursday. I'll feed him his hot pot and he'll be right as rain. You just enjoy yourself with your friend.
Fisk smiles at her gratefully and leaves. In a meadow by an expanse of water, Henslowe stands gazing thoughtfully. He turns and looks up the meadow towards a tall monumental column. He picks up a wire tray full of pots of flowering bulbs. He looks up to see a formation of birds flying across the milky sky. He walks up steps from the garden to a brick and flint built house.
But as Thursday evening arrived, I found my enthusiasm for the event waning. For in truth, the whim that prompted me to extend the invitation had lost its piquancy, and the sobering cost of Rather's Tokai played its part in making the whole venture seem somewhat dubious. I'm afraid I was mistaken about the vintage. 89 was unavailable. This is a 91. I do hope you're not too disappointed.
Not at all. One would have to have a jaded palate indeed of the prospect of a 91 Cleverheld Manschlis. A disappointment. Properly decanted. No sign of sediment. Well done.
Thank you.
Fisk pours a stream of the golden wine from the decanter into a small fluted glass.
To think that such wine was once only opened by decree of a Habsburg, and now, through the vicissitudes of history, we lesser beings can command such an audience.
Your very good health.
Spanley raises the glass to his nose and inhales its aroma, deeply serious about the entire ritual.
I must confess my first taste of Tokai was not an illuminating moment.
Oh.
Rather, my father's dismissal of it as being too syrupy for his taste seemed remarkably close to the mark. However, in the Dean, its champion was to hand.
Spanley is almost convulsing in anticipation. He sips the wine. His face melts into an expression of ecstasy.
Tokai, of course, is unique among wines in that the aroma is of more significance than the flavor. For us humans, alas, that is the pursuit of the ineffable by the inadequate. At such moments, one could wish to possess the olfactory powers of the canine.
Henslow sits, seemingly fascinated, yet slightly uncomfortable at the Dean's unbridled delight.
It's often occurred to me that to pull a dog away from a lamppost is akin to seizing a scholar in the British Museum by the scruff of his neck and dragging him away from his studies.
They both seem to have run out of conversation. Fisk leaps to his feet to investigate a disturbance outside. Spanley takes advantage of this to top up his Tokai glass.
One of those damned motor machines. Dreadful things, don't you think?
Must be clear to anyone of the slightest perception of the invention of the internal, one might even say infernal, combustion engine will prove to be a complete catastrophe for the species.
Quite so.
And have you noticed that motor cars are exactly the right height for them to take refuge under? Cats. The way they get under motor cars and can't be got at. Unless, of course, you're a very small dog.
I see what you mean.
The trouble with cats is they have no idea of the rules. One chases them, invariably they hide or run up trees, or perform that preposterous inflation they're so fond of, raising their hair on end. Well, I was never fooled by that rules.
No?
Well, perhaps once or twice when I was very young, but once I discovered what devious and subversive creatures they are.
So you are inclined to agree with the Swami about them, about cats and how they diminish man's estimation of himself.
Oh, indeed. They have no awe of the masters.
The masters?
Yes. How one loved to be in their company. How one wanted to please them, if only by obedience. Let me give you a piece of advice.
When a door is opened, always take the opportunity to leave the room. There is nothing more annoying to the master than a dog whining and scratching to get...
Dean Spanley seems to catch himself. His eyes widen. Fisk gazes gravely across the table at his guest.
Tokai?
No. No, thank you. Two glasses are my limit. One must know one's limit. Otherwise, there's no knowing where things will end up.
Fisk again leans on Rather's billiard table.
I had no idea of the true nature of what had occurred with the Dean. It may have been madness, but I found it intriguing. So intriguing that I finished the rest of the bottle.
Pulling a scholar out of the British Museum by the scruff of his neck. As if his mind had slipped a cog.
Went barking mad, you mean?
Well, no, he was completely rational.
If you can call remembering you were a dog rational.
How much of the tokai had he had?
Two glasses.
Two? Sure it wasn't you that was snogging?
So what do you think?
They're getting Dean's tiddly so that they can pretend to remember when they were a dog is as harmless a way of spending an evening as any other.
He was not tiddly, as you put it. He was, well, it was more like an altered state of mind.
And you think being tiddly isn't an altered state of mind?
No, it was the tokai. Even when he inhaled it, he was transported to this other place.
And you'd like to get him back to this other place, is that what you mean?
Can you get me another bottle? Can you?
I don't doubt that for a price, one could come to hand.
Can you get one for next Thursday?
Have another shot.
Fisk picks up his billiard cue. From a slender rail, there hang on pegs sheets of fine art paper bearing silhouettes of animals. Dean Spanley holds up the first of these, showing a pair of hares boxing. He appears to sniff at them.
Your tokai, Dean.
Ah, what lambency of hue, what colour. It reminds me of the light when the master came home. Oh, over to the brim.
Of course.
One must leave room for the aroma.
Yes, yes, the aroma.
And you were saying about the master. Oh, yes, the master. He would go away for very long times. Other people were kind, but it was not the same.
And what did you do?
I waited for him until I knew he was coming home.
You knew when he was returning?
Oh, yes.
How, might I ask?
Well, before he was not coming back, and then he was. That was the difference, plain and simple.
I see.
Yes, seeing is part of it, it's true. The proximity of the master does affect the light.
The light grows brighter.
No, not brighter, louder.
The light grows louder.
Well, certainly there was more of it. I remember waiting one day when he was due to come back. And the light that day got brighter and brighter until one was quite dazzled. I only know when he did finally come back. I was so excited I had several brandies to calm myself.
Dean, dogs do not drink brandy.
No more they do. I would achieve the same effect by running around in tight little circles. Drives the blood to the head in a most exhilarating fashion.
Dean Spanley raises his eyebrows and twinkles. A red and white spaniel frolics excitedly.
And then I'd sit down, have a good scratch.
Were you much bothered by fleas?
When I
say bothered. Well,
there's nothing wrong with a few fleas. They serve admirably to get one's grooming going. Yes. Indeed, I doubt if one can be a dog and not have fleas.
Spanley lies back in a chair by the fire and flicks his eyes towards his bemused host. Fisk Senior speaks.
So these evenings have become a regular feature, then?
Well, yes, the Dean has a wealth of knowledge which I find quite fascinating.
Come here!
But only on the Thursday.
Horatio trips the runaway child.
Never trip me up!
Don't be ridiculous! He's given to imaginings.
Uh-huh.
Pick yourself up.
I told you before about running away from me. If I call to you, you come back.
What on earth possessed you to do such a thing? No business running off like that when he was being summoned.
You talk as if you were never yourself a child.
Indeed I was. And damn glad when it was over. Too much is made of childhood to my mind. Golden days of fun and innocence, poppycock. The most miserable I've been was as a child.
And is that why you tripped him up? To teach him that childhood isn't a happy time?
Do not presume to judge me, young Fisk.
I should first have to understand you, Father. And that, I confess, I do not.
Perhaps you would have to become a father first.
Your example disinclines me to that particular comprehension, I'm afraid.
The old man drops into his bath chair.
Push on! Push on!
Henslow seethes, but seems to have no option but to obey his cantankerous father. He bends and sets to pushing the chair along the ancient cloister in which they have been talking.
You don't think the Dean is having you on, do you?
What do you mean, having me on?
Well, that he spotted you for the gullible sort, a good source for his favourite drink.
Well, why would he assume that pretending to have been a dog would not attract disbelief and ridicule rather than repeated invitations to dinner?
Well, he saw you at the Nawabs listening to the Swami about reincarnation and dogs and all that nonsense. And he decided that you believed in all that stuff.
I can't accept that. You're most unlike someone of his gravitas.
Gravitas? Telling you about running around in circles to create the effect of whiskey.
Brandy, actually.
And that fleas are a good source of grooming. Yeah, I suppose you could call that gravitas.
I tell you, he doesn't know when he's saying these things and when he isn't.
Yeah, well, I would have to be there to see it for myself to believe it.
Your Moroccan is here.
Excuse me, a delivery.
Go easy on him, my darling.
Be careful, he's monkey.
Abdul, how are you? And how much do I owe our man?
Rather's beautiful companion gazes sultrily at Fisk.
Very nice article, this. Fell off the back of an elephant. Not interested, are you?
Don't have an elephant.
Just say the word and I'll get you one.
Look about this Tokai.
Yeah, right, Tokai. How about if I do round one up? You let me sit in on the next seance.
It's not a seance. It's more like the parting of the veil between... well, between one life and another.
All right, the parting of the veil. But I want to be there.
All right. But you must promise, and I mean truly, and genuinely promise me, that you will allow me to do the questioning.
Cross my heart and hope to
die. No, I mean swear an oath on something you hold sacred.
50 guineas.
What do you mean, 50 guineas?
I'll give you 50 guineas to hold, and if I don't meet your standard of decorum, then I forfeit it.
Am I to understand from that that there is nothing you hold sacred?
I feel quite religious about 50 guineas, I assure you.
Rather smiles at his companion. In a garden.
I can only imagine that I was not in my right mind to have spoken to you in such a fashion. And it grieves me to think that I may have offended you by my lack of respect. I am stricken to think I have given you cause to think me ungrateful.
Don't grovel, laddie. You remind me of Wag when he'd been naughty. What a whining and squirming he went in for.
Yes. Wag, eh?
One of the 7 great dogs. At any one time, you know, there are only 7.
What kind of dog was he?
A Welsh spaniel. In his prime.
What happened to him?
He went away one day and never came back.
Have you ever done that before?
Never. I blame the bad company he fell in with. This dog that used to come around. Ugly brute, a mongrel, big scrawny thing it was. Wag chased him off at first, but he came back and Wag took off with him. Just before I had to return to school. I wanted to stay at home till Wag came back, but they wouldn't allow it. I told them, if I wasn't there, then Wag might not know where to come to.
It's been very difficult for you.
It wasn't difficult. It was unbearable.
Yes.
I had heard this story before, but now it was as if I was hearing it for the first time. As dubious as any connection might have seemed, my father's revelation inspired greater significance to my next encounter with the Dean.
A framed photo of a young man in uniform hangs on a wall. Rather stands looking at it.
Who's this likely-looking lad?
That's my brother Harrington. He was killed fighting the Boers. Broke my mother's heart.
And your father, how'd he take it?
If something goes to the trouble of happening, it may be considered inevitable, was his comment, I believe.
That's just stiff upper English for you. There's a few shillings left in this. Cobweb's alone are worth a guinea.
No, please, not the last inch. Dean is most particular about that.
Fussy old hound. What kind of dog do you say he was?
He didn't. I must insist you don't ask him such a question.
I would have thought that's the first question you would ask. Please, just give me your word, brother.
As you like. There's no doubt I'll know as soon as he gets stuck.
Henslow. Good evening, Dean. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I fancy I would have been a sight pointer, an Afghan.
This is my friend, Mr. Rather.
Oh.
Mr. Rather is the agent by which we managed to procure the Tokai.
Good evening, Dean.
Spanley warily takes Rather's hand and circles him, sniffing like a dog.
Tonight's vintage is a special one. Kleinfield Hasslerback, 82. One of the great years.
Indeed, I've not had the good fortune to taste that particular vintage before.
Well, every dog has his day, as they say.
Fisk glares at Rather and peremptorily takes from him the skull he has been examining.
Well, what a privilege.
Dean?
Well, of course, the Empire must be maintained, but history shows us only too clearly the dangers of overreach. I myself considered the Indian mutiny, so-called, a warning that perhaps our presence on the subcontinent was not the universal benevolence that we believed.
Fisk and Rather are slumped, eyes glazed, listening to Spanley. The Dean's eyes now flick towards the decanter.
A glass of Tokai, Dean. That would be most agreeable.
So, Dean, do you think it's true that you can't teach an old dog new tricks?
What Mr. Rather means is...
Will we ever give India back to the Indians?
Not in my lifetime, I would venture. We've become too dependent on it. And I don't just mean economically, although we derive inordinate treasure from its exploitation. No. We have become habituated to the role of master... dog. Servant.
Spanley brings his glass to his nose.
Oh. How elegant. My.
Is it all you'd hoped for, Dean?
Spanley takes a sip of the wine and closes his eyes as he savours it. Rather sits across from him, unconsciously mirroring the Dean's trembling lips.
Beyond hope, beyond imagining. The actuality exceeds anticipation. I am in your debt, sir. And yours, Mr. Rather.
You were saying about our relationship with the Indians, between the master and the servant.
Not just servant, but loving servant. It's most important to the English race that we are loved by those that we rule.
With a dog-like devotion, would you say?
What is it that's so important about the master?
Yes, the master. The thing is, whenever he returned from wherever he'd been, no matter how long I'd been waiting, the actuality always exceeded the anticipation.
Causing you to run about in circles.
Fisk shoots a look at Rather.
But, you know, for all his great wisdom, there were certain things the master never understood.
Such as?
The moon and ticks. Master always wanted to rule move mine, but my own motto was live and let live.
I hate ticks. And the moon?
Yes, the moon. The master wasn't nearly suspicious enough of the moon. I never trusted it. Never the same two nights in a row. Couldn't hear it, couldn't smell it. Might have to take your own light on that, and others do. I had a friend who'd never worried about the moon, but then he didn't have a house to guard. And the moon had a way of looking at a house that implied that it wasn't guarded properly. Well, my house was guarded properly, thank you very much, and I told it so. Every time it came around, I told it so, no uncertain terms!
The red and white spaniel barks up at a fine full moon. The dog dances in circles on the gravel drive of a house.
Well, you're very big.
Oh, yes.
How big?
When I barked, I was enormous.
So, why do you think it wasn't frightened?
Well, frightened things smell frightened. I've smelled many frightened things. Cats, elderly ladies, children, rabbits. They all smell of being frightened. It's a wonderful smell.
You mean old ladies smell the same as rabbits when they're frightened?
No, their fear smells the same. Otherwise, there's no confusing them.
Yes, this business of smell is very interesting, isn't it?
Interesting. If there's one thing I could find fault with the master, it would be on that issue. I've known occasions when I was studying a message left for me by a friend, and he would drag me away by the collar in the middle of the most fascinating passage.
Rather like dragging a scholar away from a text at the British Museum.
That is a rather untoward analogy.
Oh, most apposite. I believe I've thought exactly the same thing.
What sort of a dog were you anyway?
I beg your pardon?
I mean, in your day. You know, before you took holy orders.
I recall no such activity, sir.
Fisk turns a look of angry frustration on Rather. Rather runs out from his house and across the square. He bounds up the steps to an imposing public building. In what would appear to be a library, he encounters Henslow Fisk.
Quite a session. Damn good value.
Listen, Rather, I've been thinking this is getting out of hand. The man is clearly suffering from delusions. And as for the tucker, I sincerely hope I never develop a taste for it. It's hard to find, and it's devilishly expensive. 10 guineas to hear a dean say he believed he was once a dog. Must be mad.
Good as gold.
I don't want your money. This has gone too far.
But you can't stop now, young Fisk.
Well, I see no point in continuing. The man believes what he believes. That's that.
You're not one of these blokes who gives up before he can lose, are you? Are you?
Fisk cannot hold Rather's piercing gaze. Rather sits down.
What if I was to procure a bottle of the elixir for free?
For free?
Fisk, wrapped up in his coat, sits in the passenger seat of Rather's open motor car.
This bloke owes me. He owes me more than one favour too, I'll tell you that. And if anyone's got a bottle or two, he's no abship will.
Tokai, you say? An imperial?
Finding it hard to come by.
I should jolly well think so. Rather extravagant being so keen on it, I'd say. You must be quite the connoisseur.
It's not for him. It's for Dean Spanley.
Spanley? Old wag Spanley likes Tokai.
Very partial to a drop, the Dean.
Excuse me. Did you just call Dean Spanley wag?
Walter Arthur Graham. Wag Spanley. Before my time, but my father knew him at Oxford. But tell me, why are you so intent on plying him with Tokai?
Well, it has to do with... one of the major tenets of your religion.
Bat and bad together when playing forward.
Reincarnation, actually.
Don't go in for it myself. I mean, I'm not going to do much better next time round, am I? This innings will do me nicely. Reincarnation is all right for the masses. Gives them something to look forward to. About the Tokai, have a look in the cellar. Goldsworthy will show you around. There's all sorts down there. Wouldn't be surprised if you found the odd case of Tokai. Don't like it myself. Last time I drank it, I dreamt I was a monkey.
Thought the funny bugger might have a dozen or two hanging around. Should be more than enough there to get the old boy back to when he was a pup.
My father used to have a dog when he was a child. Name of Wag.
You know, I've been thinking. Lady I know in the thespian way. Thought we might give her a bottle of the Imperial. Lovely girl. A lot of fun when she's tight.
Fisk cradles on his lap a wooden crate of bottles bedded in straw.
I think for that to be significant, you'd have to suppose two things, neither of which are probable. One, that the Dean's mum and dad knew that he'd previously been your father's pooch. And two, to commemorate the event, decided to incorporate his doggy name into his Christian name. It may look like a boat, but it doesn't float, as my Aunt Molly used to say.
And why would I want to have dinner with a Dean? Let alone one who believes in reincarnation.
Because you're always complaining that I neglect you on my evenings with Spanley. Thought you'd like to come with us. Rather will be there. You remember him. The conveyancer. From the lecture.
Can't say as I do. We must be here, this gathering, certainly not at that rickety place of yours.
Can Mrs. Brimley cook for four?
She can make more of her hot pot.
Father, we are having a Chevenitz Donetschau 79. And I do not think the hot pot, sustaining though it may be, is quite the precursor for a 79 Tokai.
Damn fuss over fermented grapes. What is all this to do with the Dean, the Tokai, this dinner?
If I were to tell you, Father, you would not believe me.
In that case, don't tell me. I don't believe in enough things already.
Well, it won't be the hot pot. That's all I can say. Oh, I'm not serving hot pot to a Dean. I could do the Navaran. With the sorrel and cucumber soup to start. Or maybe leek and potato. What your father calls a vicious Swiss soup.
Either would be most welcome. Mrs. Brimley, do you remember my father's dog? Wag.
And for dessert, profiteroles.
I think it was a spaniel.
My shoe pastry is too good to be eaten, if I say so myself. Wag? No, not really. I remember it run off, though. What a to-do that was, like a death in the family. Upset him ever so. Why didn't he get another, I asked him once. Know what he said?
That Wag was one of the seven great dogs.
I see he talked to you about it. Mm-hmm. Maybe profiteroles would be too heavy after the lamb. Raspberry and gooseberry fool.
Whatever you decide, Mrs. Brimley, I'm sure would be splendid. A 79?
Yes, indeed. Really, my dear Henslow, you are a man of remarkable resource.
Oh, it's not I who provided this trove, sir. Hmm? My father, whom I believe you have met before.
Yes, I believe I do recall.
I was rather hoping that he might join us for our next evening together.
I see. And your friend.
Rather, Mr. Rather.
Rather, yes. I have the strangest feeling, you know, after our last encounter. But I know Mr. Rather, perhaps from a previous life. I was not always a dean, you know.
No?
No. I was an accountancy at one time. Dismal business. At least in the regions where I toiled.
And you feel like you met Mr. Rather then?
Yes, it's possible. Or perhaps just being a colonial. One often feels one's met them before.
So, can I hope for your company this Thursday? I do feel only your palate can fully appreciate a 79.
79. What splendor is a bottle of the 79? Three bottles.
Spanley's jaw drops.
Might be best to let sleeping dogs lie, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I know what you mean.
What if he recognises your father? Starts licking his hands. That could be damned embarrassing.
Pick me, Judge, old man.
Pick me, Judge.
So, there we were on our holidays in this cottage on the shore of Windermere. Wonderful spot to get some reading done, and I was availing myself of the tranquility to do just that. This fellow here, young Fisk, and his brother were out on the lake in a rowboat. Storm came up. One minute it's all I wandered, lonely as a cloud, the next it's blowing hell's bells and howling like a banshee. Mrs. Fisk, she comes in, wringing her hands. Our boys, she cries at me, they're out on the lake. You have no idea how taxing it is to be dragged out of a book in which you are thoroughly engaged. You must do something, Horatio, she said to me. Our boys are in great danger. Do something, she implored me. So I got up, laying aside Balzac with the greatest reluctance, and went to the window, opened the shutters. White caps as far as the eye could see. I stared out into the maelstrom, and I raised my hands and called out in my most stentorian tone, give up your debt.
Which was a great comfort, as you can imagine, to my mother.
When one is helpless, I see no point in pretending otherwise.
How terrible that must have been for your mother. And you too, sir.
When something has gone to the trouble of happening, it is best to consider it inevitable, in my opinion. Learned that lesson the hard way, I did.
Well, let us drink to the inevitable before it happens.
Henzo glances at Rather as they all raise their glasses. Spanley starts to quiver.
Not a bad drop. I'm beginning to get a hang of this stuff.
Too much like toilet water for my taste. Clear away the rest, Mrs. Brimley. She makes a very good hot pot, I should tell you.
Mrs. Brimley glares.
Well, let's take this in the drawing room.
If you wouldn't mind, sir. I should prefer to remain here to enjoy my Tokai.
Oh? And why is that?
I cannot really say.
Sometimes you get comfortable where you are. You don't want to disturb yourself.
Poppycock. Port should be taken in the drawing room. Let the ladies get on with whatever it is they get on with.
I'm no lady.
Like being bathed when one has just gotten comfortable in one's smell.
What is the fellow on about?
Shh. There's a patch of ground out behind the shed where the earth was always moist, and I loved to roll there to get a particular aura around me. It brought out the natural secretion, so one could feel there was a glow around oneself, like a halo. And it was then when I felt so complete that the master would call me.
Who, in God's name, called you what?
The master. He called me Wag, for reasons I never understood. Wag. But that was the greatness of the master, that he could make that one sound convey so many meanings. There was a wag, which meant a walk. There was a wag, which meant go away from the table. And there was a wag, which meant you are to be bathed. And of all the wags, that wag was the most terrible.
Why was that?
Because for all his great wisdom, he never understood how embarrassing it is to meet another dog when one isn't wearing one's own smell. But more importantly, they did not know who you were, so you had to go through all that business of circling and sniffing and growling, and I was always being embarrassed in that way with a particular friend of mine.
So what'd you do? You have to fight him.
Well, we fought a few times just to get acquainted. That I enjoyed.
My favorite grip was the ear. You always hear how going for the throat is the best approach, but in my experience, it's almost impossible to get a throat grip, so I would always go for the ear. But it does give the opportunity for excellent complaint. My friend had a very good complaint, which I memorized, and I would use if I had to take a beating from the master.
He beat you?
Only on certain occasions, he was called for, certainly. And then I would use this splendid complaint, which I learned from my friend.
So what was his name, this friend of yours?
His name? I don't think I knew the name his master called him. Indeed, not entirely sure he had a master, but his complaint was most satisfying. Oh, rescue me, I'm a poor, unfortunate creature, far from home, and without a friend. Help me, help me. I have fallen into terrible straits, and am about to be murdered. Which, of course, was not the case.
This dog, the one without a master, what sort of dog was he?
Oh, the best of fellows. Adventurous and carefree, fearless and bold.
But you said he was whining and snivelling about being murdered.
Oh, that was just his complaint.
How'd you meet him, this friend?
He would leave messages on the cart that brought the milk.
Horatio has been gaping in amazement throughout Dean Spanley's monologue. White clouds are swirled on a radiant blue sky. The great hairy hooves of a dray horse plod along. A tall, grey, wiry-haired hound sniffs the wheel of the cart the horse is pulling. It raises its hind leg to the wheel. As the dog moves off, the red and white spaniel appears.
And I would reply. And then one day, he came to our door. Well, I told him to go away or I would chase him, and I barked my most enormous bark and made myself very huge. But he wasn't afraid and said so.
You weren't, how will I put it, a female by any chance, were you?
Of course he wasn't.
Not at all. We were good friends. He led a very interesting life. And knew many more things than I did, which he told me about in considerable detail.
How did he tell you?
In the messages that he left me. And I would leave word of my doings, which I confess were not comparable to his, because all I'd ever done was go for evening walks with the master. And while they were enjoyable outings, they were but moon-cast shadows compared to his adventures.
Did you ever go on an adventure with him?
Indeed. The greatest of my life. I remember the master had to go away and I couldn't go with him. I was going to follow him. But then my friend came and he proposed we have an adventure. Since the master was leaving, I said yes, and off we went.
The spaniel pushes open a pair of iron gates and the two dogs bound away together through sun-dappled grass beneath the trees.
What a day that was to be a dog, and to be with one who knew how to be a dog, for I confess, happy though I was to belong to the master, until that day I had barely glimpsed the glories of dogdom. He introduced me to the joys of chasing animals, a matter in which I was largely unversed, having previously only had the opportunity to chase a couple of cats. Cats, you know, have no use for chasing, for not knowing the rules, they invariably climb up trees, a habit I find contemptible. Horses, on the other hand, understand the rules perfectly and enter the business in good spirit.
Rather and Henslow follow the Dean's exposition with interest. Fisk Sr. stares transfixed. The two dogs lollop joyfully through a meadow in pursuit of a beautiful white horse.
Of all the creatures that a dog can chase, none exceed sheep or share pleasure.
A flock of sheep appear, jumping like fleas over the brow of a hill.
Their fear drifts in clouds behind them, and you breathe it in as you run along, so you become quite intoxicated by it. It's as if one is not so much running, but flying on it. Or perhaps swimming might be a more exact description. And were it not for their master appearing, you might have chased them all day.
An irate farmer runs down the slope and pitches a stone at the dogs.
My friend, of course, didn't care, but I thought we might be seized and prevented from further adventure, so I persuaded him to leave. And so we went into the woods. And there we had the good fortune to come across a rabbit.
A fat brown rabbit hops into a glade and looks around cautiously.
It's not commonly known that rabbit scent, particularly when it's frightened, and this rabbit was very frightened indeed, does not lie along the ground, but rises in heaps, so you have to jump to inhale it. When we'd had our fill of its fear, we turned to catching it, and in this endeavor, my friend showed what a splendid fellow he was, for he drove straight through the thicket, paying no heed to its many inconveniences, and sent the rabbit scuttling to where I was stationed.
The spaniel waits, ready to pounce, its jaws open and wet. As the rabbit runs into view, the spaniel leaps. Both dogs now pull at the rabbit with their jaws. On the sunlit bank of a stream, the dogs lie gnawing peacefully. Mrs. Brimley walks along the corridor, wearing a rather tight-lipped expression.
How much more satisfying a recently alive rabbit tastes. I'm afraid the masters fail to appreciate fur, guts and bones for the delicacies that they are.
Mrs. Brimley screws up her face in disgust.
Then it was time to quench our thirst.
Henslow hurries to refill the Dean's Tokay glass. Horatio holds out his glass too.
And then, as in all things that befell us on that glorious day, we came across some water that had gathered in a hollow. And after we drank our fill, we rolled in it to give ourselves a good glow. And then we went into the woods to rest in the shade.
Perhaps we should take up...
Father, be quiet and sit down, please.
Horatio pipes down and humbly crosses to sit in the chair next to where Spanley has placed himself.
You went into the woods and...
Then we slept. That most sublime of states. When the dream dreams you rather than the other way round.
The two dogs lie spread out on the soft grass beneath a tree by a small stream. Tiny twitchings occur in their limbs and around their eyes and muzzles.
And when we awoke, the moon was rising. It was just on the other side of the woods, so we set about surprising it.
The dogs bound through undergrowth striped with ice-white moonlight.
And we came very close to catching it, but slow to get up. But just when we were almost on it, my friend couldn't control himself any longer and let out a cry! Had we been there but a moment sooner, we surely would have seized it and torn it apart like the rabbit. How it would have tasted, I cannot tell. So, we told it what a great, cowardly, unsmelling thing it was. And if we ever caught up with it, we'd surely regret it. Then we turned around, went home.
So you knew the way home?
Oh, yes. Turn towards home and go there.
But you had been out all day, running free. How far from home were you?
Yes, we'd gone many overs, that is true. How many, I couldn't tell.
Overs?
Overs, many overs, over woods and fields, streams and hills. Many overs.
And you just... turn towards home.
How else would one do it?
Then why?
And I knew I should be beaten. I remembered my friend's complaint that I would use, and how delicious it would feel when the beating had stopped and the insults had finished. Yes, the glow of having paid the price for wrongdoing.
And were you punished?
No, not on that occasion.
Why was that, do you know?
Because a very remarkable thing happened on the way back.
The spaniel bounds across a moonlit meadow. The other dog appears at a run and overtakes the spaniel.
Which I cannot fully explain. One moment we're running along side by side heading for home, and the next...
The two dogs bound through long grass. They slow to a halt. The angry farmer stands facing them, his face contorted with rage and a shotgun levelled by his cheek. The dogs wag their tails innocently. The farmer fires.
We were not.
Henslow looks across at his father, who stares tragically wide-eyed at Dean Spanley.
I cannot say what happened. Perhaps it was a dream, and I wakened from it.
Henslow's younger brother Harrington ambles across the veldt on horseback. He removes his hat and stops to look up at the full moon. As the shot rings out, we cut back to Horatio, whose expression is at last becoming softened by emotion.
Was there any pain?
Pain, no. I cannot say there was.
Harrington lies on his back. His horse nibbles the grass by his feet.
All I can remember is how clear the night was, and with the moon cast shadows, and the earth rising underneath me, and home in my heart, and the master waiting. But no, no pain.
Horatio gazes across at Spanley. There seems to be moisture in his eyes. Henslow, likewise, seemingly on the brink of tears, gazes across at his father. Horatio eventually lets his head fall and closes his eyes, weeping softly. He reaches a hand across to Dean Spanley.
I am most glad to hear it.
Horatio pats Spanley's hand. The Dean's expression becomes confused.
If you will excuse me.
Did I say something to upset you, sir?
No, not at all. I am put in memory of my son, Harrington. That is all.
Horatio totters away. Henslow watches him go. He turns back to the others, clearly struggling to contain his own emotion.
Harrington was killed in the Boer War. Returning from a patrol. That's all we know. The body was never recovered.
Dean Spanley looks gravely at Henslow. Into the semi-lit hallway, Horatio walks unsteadily. He stops, then, holding onto the wall, crosses to sink down painfully onto a wooden bench. He drops his head. Mrs. Brimley appears at the end of the corridor. Seeing Fisk sitting there, she stops in amazement.
Are you all right, Mr. Fisk?
Fisk turns his distraught face to her.
You were shot.
Yes.
As he dissolves in tears, Mrs. Brimley crosses to cradle him.
Oh, there. There. Better late than never, Mr. Fisk. Come with me.
She helps him into her parlour.
In you go, Mr. Fisk. Sit yourself down.
He dabs his eyes and stares around him, slightly bewildered.
He does mither on, that dean of yours.
Fisk crosses slowly but purposefully to the mantelpiece. He picks up a small silver two-windowed photo frame containing separate pictures of two young boys. Dean Spanley is preparing to leave.
Whatever I said did not upset him.
Excuse me. I was talking to Mrs. Brimley about the old days. Thank you, Dean, for coming. It was a memorable evening.
No, thank you, sir. I fear the talk I rendered me somewhat unsociable. It has a tendency to make me withdraw into myself.
Not at all. You were all that could be hoped for in a guest. You know your way home from here. Just turn towards it is the best way, I'm told.
I'm going in the Dean's direction. I'll see the guest there this time.
Good of you to come, Mr. Rather.
Wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Good night, Dean. Good night.
Henslow closes the door. Dean Spanley stands at the top of the house steps. Rather's slightly roguish look and his grey, wiry hair and beard are reminiscent of the other dog.
You know, Mr. Rather, I have the most persistent notion that we have met before.
One often feels that about colonials, Dean.
Yes, I have heard that said. Nevertheless,
you're not in the market for a new rug, are you, Dean? I've got this good friend in Marrakesh.
Marrakesh?
Colourful, exciting place, if you know the right people. I know the right people.
Something of an adventure, I imagine.
Henslow is preparing to leave.
He can put away the tocker, I'll say that for the Dean.
I thought for a moment we might have had to open the third bottle.
Oh, two was ample, I think. He goes on a bit when he's in his cups, though.
Thank you, Father.
Horatio continues straightening the coat he has helped Henslow into.
One moment you are running along, the next you are no more.
Well,
Henslow finds he has uncharacteristically taken the liberty of placing a hand on his father's shoulder. They share a look. Horatio's expression seems to brim with love. They embrace, holding each other tight. Henslow finally kisses his father on the cheek.
I will see you next Thursday.
Or any day that suits. Mustn't get too set in our ways. Good night, Henslow.
Good night, Father.
They smile warmly at each other, and then Henslow takes his leave. Horatio remains standing there, still smiling.
Something about rabbits tasting better with their fur. You won't catch me cooking them, that's all I can say.
Horatio laughs to hear Mrs. Brimley talking to her late husband.
Then, he comes in here. First time in God knows how long. And he stands looking at that photograph, sobbing his heart out.
Horatio walks slowly up the stairs. Daytime. Henslow bounds up the steps to his father's house and knocks on the door. Mrs. Brimley answers.
Morning, Mrs. Brimley.
It's not Thursday, you know.
No, I know. How's Father?
Well, I don't know, really. Wasn't my idea, you know. The day after that dinner, he sent me round to see that friend of yours. The one was here,
Mr. Rather?
Sent me round with a letter he did. Next day, he shows up with a dog.
What kind of dog?
Oh, one of those... like before.
A spaniel? Must be one of the seven.
One's quite enough in this house, thank you very much. It's already chewed a cushion. He's in the garden. Imagine, Mr. Fisk in the garden. He'll be growing roses next.
Henslow looks out through the window. A young spaniel bounds across the snow-covered lawn to where Horatio sits on a bench. Henslow gazes out through the window as his father joyfully teases the dog with his hat, making it run in tight circles. A tiny smile plays on Henslow's lips. Mrs. Brimley looks across at him in satisfaction and then turns and leaves the room.
That was the end of my talks with Dean Spanley, although my father sometimes saw him at the club. Don't know what they talked about, if anything. As for the question of reincarnation, I resolved to wait and see, albeit with more anticipation than hitherto. And should I find myself in the form of a dog, I trust I will be so fortunate as to belong to a master as kind as my father.
Henslow, smiling slightly, turns away from the window. Outside in the garden, Horatio remains sitting on the bench, the dog at his feet, gazing almost as if with wonder ahead of him. He turns slowly to look towards the house. His expression crystallizes into a subtle but intense smile. The end.